Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor John Goodman. You know, John Goodman wasn't always the imposing presence he is today, but he's always had his charisma. As an eighth grader in Missouri, John charmed the hard guys in school with a spot-on Gomer Pyle impression, so they would protect him. As he explains, I was a little fat kid. I had the glasses with the tape in the middle. I was nerdy, man. Well, that nerdiness went away, and as John got older, he became heavily influenced by Marlon Brando and captivated by the language of Shakespeare. John discovered his dream to become an actor and left the Midwest for New York to make it happen. After a stint as Thomas Jefferson in a dinner theater rendition of 1776, John found commercial success in New York City. But his career really took off when Roseanne came along in the late 80s. He's also been a fixture in several Coen Brothers movies, including Raising Arizona, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, The Big Lebowski, and others, bringing his characteristic physicality to roles that simmer with an explosive energy. Exhibit A, screaming obscenities and beating the bejesus out of a Corvette with a crowbar in The Big Lebowski. That on-screen volatility was also present in John's off-screen life. Decades of heavy drinking forced John to confront his demons, and as a self-described egomaniac with an inferiority complex, he has come out the other side with humility, grace, and an endearingly self-deprecating sense of humor. His perspective on his life and career is downright fascinating. John brings candor and wit to our off-camera conversation. We discuss why everything is on the page with the Coen brothers, how Roseanne came back after a 21-year hiatus, why John in his early 20s looked for trouble in Central Park, and how the movie Animal House was a terrible influence. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, John.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
It is distinctly my pleasure.
It's fun to have you here in my studio. And because the last time we really spent time together, as you reminded me, was England. And before that, it was Germany.
Yeah.
And here's something you don't know. I was almost your co-star on that film.
Which role?
On Monuments Men, that you were in, George Clooney directed, and that's where I met you, and we spent time. George wrote a part for me as a Stars and Stripes photographer.
Yeah.
And you know, I had a few lines and everything, and I got really nervous leading up to it once I read the script, and I started doing the, you know, the thing that Kramer does on Seinfeld.
Yeah.
You know, these pretzels are making me thirsty. And you know, practicing my lines and everything. And then I get over there to Germany, and I find out that he's cut the scene.
But he got you over there.
He got me over there. But, you know, the world never got to see my acting talents.
It's not even on the floor somewhere.
No, it's not. It didn't even get shot.
But you're still rehearsing the line?
I still...
That's what I do. Every time I finish a movie, there's a line or two. God damn it, why didn't I do it that way?
Is that true?
Oh, all the time.
And the realization will happen later, and you'll be like, now I know how to play it?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, it less and less, but I still do it.
Well, when I was in high school, I was in a few plays, and I got kind of laughed out of theater. And then it got squashed by the fact that I developed really late and I...
Yeah, it's funny. I'm a late bloomer myself.
Is that true?
Yeah, and my emotional stability was never up to it until I got out of alcohol treatment. And then I kind of... Because they say when you start drinking heavily, that's the age you remain. And I was 27 or something like that, but I was still very immature.
See, that strikes me as crazy. When I think of you, I think of, oh, this guy probably was, you know, a big football-playing jock, all that stuff.
I went down to what was then Southwest Missouri State College to try to walk on the team, and my grades were terrible. I was slower than anybody, but the only thing I did was like to hit, and I liked to be part of a team. But I was really, you know, they weren't that interested. They said, you're going to have to come back when your grades improved, and I was hanging on by my fingernails in college because I was so immature. And then a couple months later, I got involved in the theater department. And I was a late bloomer there. I couldn't get any classes when I first transferred. And when I did, it changed my life.
No kidding.
Yeah, it gave me a focus. Like I said, I like doing this. I really enjoyed the discipline because I'd had none.
Well, you say you had none. Did you grow up? I mean, I read that your dad died when you were really young.
It was a month before my second birthday.
Oh my gosh!
And my sister was born about 4 months later.
Oh, so your mom was pregnant with your sister
with
when your dad died.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories of him at all?
None.
None.
I think I have flashes of being in a swimming pool, but I can't trust them.
Huh.
I don't trust my own memory because it's been, I had 30 good years of erasing the tape.
Did your best to scrub the history.
I feel pretty bad. Maybe this will make me feel better. There you go.
But, I can't imagine not having a dad. I mean, the dads were sort of the disciplinarians of that era.
I can't imagine having one.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I missed a lot, apparently. My brother's 14 years older than I am. They told my mom she couldn't have any more children.
Really?
Yeah, so he came back to St. Louis after a while and started, he goes, you're going to the Y twice a week. Okay.
So he kind of tried
to step
in. Yeah,
because I was a little fat kid. What I was doing, I was eating addictively.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just puffed up, and he tried to take care of that, and then I started getting involved in football.
Was there money in the house? Did you guys have money?
We had the house. The house was paid for.
Okay.
And then she got Dad's Social Security benefits. She went out and she would take in kids. She babysit all day.
Okay.
Take in laundry. She got a job at a drugstore helping people, I guess. They paid $40 a week.
So your dad's not around. Your mom's working all the time.
Yeah.
You're kind of on your own.
Yeah.
From a young age.
Yeah. Which I don't mind, but in my case, I started eating.
Right.
Yeah, I'd sneak food.
Sneak it into your room at night.
Yeah. Just, make games out of eating.
Really?
Yeah.
Did someone else step in besides your brother? And did your mom remarry or anything?
No.
No.
She had boyfriends, but they didn't like us, the kids.
So what was that like?
Well, we didn't like them right back. it was hard on my mother. In retrospect, and she, she'd always talk about Dad and this, and so she had a rough time.
Yeah.
And then we got raised. We been spoiled a little bit. You got two kids running around going, gimme, 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 I want what I see on TV. Can I have it? Can I have it? Can I have it? No. Can I have it? Can I have it? Okay. But it was great. Once I got the television show, I could get her a house.
Oh, yeah.
And make sure she was taken care of. And it just gave me a good feeling. I'd hear embarrassing stories about her in the grocery line.
Oh.
She couldn't not talk about me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can imagine the pride that she must have felt, right?
I guess. But she finally had something to brag about.
Yeah, right. What were you?
Me. We'll fix that shit.
Did you ever, indulge her a little bit and come home and let her take you out to dinner and kind of indulge the supermarket line?
It was a great pleasure to go back to St. Louis. Great pleasure, because I always stuck close to the high school guys.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I mean, like I said before, I was really immature. And I was in ninth grade, I started hanging around with the in crowd and get turned on. All these guys listened to African-American radio stations. And when I got that in my head, it was life-changing. Yeah, KSHE-FM, St. Louis, Missouri, right now, Hendrix.
I think people who are younger don't realize the impact of radio in that period.
It was immense. We had a disc jockey on KMOX, KXOK, named Johnny Rabbit. And he had the Johnny Rabbit Army. And I was in the Johnny Rabbit Army. This is when I was still more nerdy. But radio was huge. It was in everybody's car. And I'd go through phases where I'd listen to Top 40. Then I'd go over to KATZ, 1600 on your dial, the last spot on your dial for soul and blues music in St. Louis, Missouri. And get into those shows. And, gee, I want to be black. The cat at the car wash says, no, you can't be. You got to look at me, man. We had a great station in St. Louis called KMOX with broadcasts of the Cardinals, and Jack Buck worked there.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to be a DJ.
You did?
Yeah, it just seemed like everybody listened to you, and they were always funny, and they got to listen to music all the time. I didn't know what went into it, and I didn't know how hard that job was. I mean, my brother saved up $1,000 for me to go to grad school, and my freshman year I wanted to blow it and go to Columbia School of Broadcasting.
God, it sounds like your brother was pretty amazing guy.
I got my sense of humor from him. He'd make me shut up while he turned on Bob and Ray on NBC Monitor. Ernie Kovacs, Sid Caesar, later on.
Was there a film you remember when you were young where you're like, well, maybe I could do that, or I want to do that, or was there a film?
I remember something I never thought I could do, but my 16th birthday, we went to the drive-in. I bought, through two friends, a case of malt liquor. And my friends took off to look for girls, and I sat and watched Romeo and Juliet by myself. But it really made an effect on me. And I said, I'd like to be able to speak like that.
Really? It was the language that got you.
Yeah. And then later, watching On the Waterfront, The Wild One.
Yeah.
Streetcar Named Desire.
Brando was a big influence.
Brando was huge. I was overly obsessed with Brando.
Can you explain that
to me? When I was in college.
Because I'm, you know, by the time I was looking at films, it was a different era. And everyone I talked to from that time and every serious actor, Brando is their sort of touchstone. And I want to know what it was that he was doing that was so different.
To me?
Yeah.
He was a poet. He would condense everything into its essence. I think later on he had a beautiful technique where he would talk to you and be talking to you like this and be reading his lines the whole time. But he knew where to place the cue cards so it would have an effect. When I saw Last Tango in Paris, he was giving a speech over his wife, dead wife. And he did that one time and it just floored me. It threw me back against my chair. One simple little essence. And he was reading his lines.
No kidding.
Yeah, but he knew where to put them. And then The Godfather came out.
Right.
Which is just pure poetry in an acting scale. But he made it, gave it the illusion of reality. But better than reality is truth. And he would dig and get the truth of the scene.
And as an actor, you're watching this, are you trying to figure out, like, is it a mystery to you?
Yeah, man. So by that time I was in college. And you go to the basics, you go to the Stanislavski books. You go to a pre-studio guy named Richard Boleslavski, who wrote a wonderful book called Six Lessons of Acting. But you go to the books, you can't really learn anything until you're practicing it with someone else. And you let the drama happen between you, your scene partner, or between you and God, whoever you're talking to in a monologue.
And is that teachable, what he was doing?
I don't think so. He was his own genius. He was the beginning and end of what he was creating. No one could do it, but they tried. You could see Brando knockoffs.
Yeah.
They're a matter of parody now. When Paul Newman first started.
Do you see a lot of Brando? In his performance,
yeah,
you could see that?
Yeah, you could see the style.
As an actor, do you think you watch films completely differently?
I know I can't watch films with myself.
To this day.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable. I'll watch them, but it's just, man, why did I do that?
Can you ever see your own emulations? So you go, I copped a bit of Brando.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I steal. I've stolen from Al Pacino, everybody. But you do your own thing after a while. And I still steal from everybody I can because I'll see something that inspires me to do something else. Man, I'm open for anything. A lot of times I'm desperate. And I gotta remember to relax and just let the spirit take you. Let the peace take you, let the room take you, wherever it's gonna take you. And every time I try to force it, to be better, or preconceived notion, what I'm going to bring in, it fails.
It's a funny thing, because I think what you're describing is acting instinctually rather than intellectually and having a plan.
Yeah. Now, there's a great mixture you can have of heart and intellect, which you'll see in Kevin Kline, the late John Hurd, Bill Hurd. There's a definite mind working there. But a guy like Daniel Day-Lewis, another poet, what is he thinking? What's he going to do next? Because of his stillness. It's like watching Mark Rylance on stage. There's a passive jumble of things going on, but he won't move a muscle, and you're going to go right to him.
So when you watch something like that, do you go, oh, I can see some of the method there, or I can see...
I usually switch it off and watch the movie.
Yeah? Can you do that?
Yeah. I get sucked into things, and there'll be bad performances while I go... Well, it doesn't matter because I suspend my disbelief.
Right. What I notice in a lot of your performances is that in some of your characters, there may be something lurking under the surface that you only let out a little bit every now and then. So the viewer can almost wonder if they're putting that up. You know, like in Barton Fink, after you run down the hall and you're firing the gun and you sit on the bed, and it's almost like you're letting the mask slip just a little bit and putting it back up. And it's what we do as human beings. We think we're fooling the world. And I guess acting's such a mystery to me of how you modulate that. And
it's a mystery to me, too. If I set out to do the things you describe, I'd fail miserably. It's just something that happens. And Barton Fink, you've got a script by Joel and Ethan Coen, and you let the script do the work and just hang on for the ride. The writing is so damn good, it lessens my workload. When I try to work, things get sticky. It's when you let it happen, for me anyway.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with that idea of how much as humans we want to control things and do all the hard work and all the research and keep the critical voice at bay so that when we come in to do our thing on the day, we feel prepared. But at the same time, sometimes that thinking can spoil the instinctual.
Well, for me anyway, and lately I've been working so much in so many different places away from home that I get fatigued. I start getting fatigued early, and then I make lazy choices. And then I do stuff that just get me through the day, and I got to be very careful of that. I have to catch myself at it. And you start to resent being on the road. So I'm taking a little break now until something fabulous comes up. And it may not, but I'm letting myself off the hook for a while. I'm giving myself permission to relax, man. It'll only make, I don't want to say this, make the instrument better.
You know, I relate to that because every time I catch myself talking about something in terms of highfalutin, I just hear... Everyone in my high school and everyone, you know what I mean?
Shut up.
Exactly.
Oh, F-stops. Oh, listen to Mr. Avedon.
Exactly. Okay, so here's my question. When you're in school, you almost have access to all this great writing,
yeah.
and then you go out and try to do it for a living, and it gets much harder, right?
Because... Well, getting a job is impossible. I went up to New York with $1,000 that my brother gave me, and I wasted it on an acting school, at which it was like taking a step backwards from where I'd been in college. And luckily enough, I got a job right away in a dinner theater in Springboro, Ohio.
Really?
Yeah, playing Thomas Jefferson in 1776.
Wait, so you went to New York and then you left New York?
Yeah, I had to. I couldn't get arrested in New York. And that proved to be true for a long time. I'd get off Broadway jobs, which was great. I started 40 years ago this year. I started with commercials so I could support myself as an actor.
In New York.
And take cocaine and start drinking heavily. Yeah, as soon as I figured out, all I wanted to do when I got to New York was make a living as an actor. And as soon as I started doing that, I go, I just got dumped by a girl. Animal House was a terrible influence on me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I discovered the miracle of cocaine.
How did you afford that?
Well, commercials, unemployment checks. But I couldn't afford it.
Don't follow this career path. It was rare.
Well, I overly romanticized it because all the hot shots were taking it, and it was just overly romanticized. Copping the stuff was more fun than actually using it. Trying to track it down, and who knows this guy, and you'd have to make 50 or 60 block trips to cop, then go back to where you were. So it just seemed more special than it actually was. And all you're doing is chasing the very first high that you ever had that was so good. Anything after that is, you're chasing it.
Right.
But it got as close to an addiction as alcohol was. It was just being able to use it. And it keeps me up so I can get drunker.
You have these two sides to yourself. One side, it seems like there is, and don't scoff at the term, but there's this artist that loves poetry and loves good writing and seeking this pure experience of honest expression in the theater. And this other side, which is like hell-bent on self-destruction.
Oh, yeah. But you justify that by looking at how many actors and good writers were alcoholics. Oh, that's okay. I'm just following in a good footstep.
Yeah, we do romanticize those kinds of things. And I think Animal House is a great example because it did make that whole lifestyle seem incredibly attractive.
Well, I got to New York at the same time as Saturday Night Live a couple of months earlier.
What was that, like 75?
It was 1975. They aired in October. I got up there in August. It was scary, especially for me. I'm a hick from Missouri coming in and gosh. And I developed a love-hate thing with it immediately.
You did?
Because I was always broke and I was always scared.
Did you ever get mugged?
No. There were times when I would go into Central Park looking for a fight.
You're kidding me.
No. Just if anybody
fucked with me. Just being drunk and wanting to...
Yeah, I was at the bulletproof stage of alcoholism before I turned into the invisible man.
What do you mean?
Well, first it's fun. Then after a while you get bulletproof. Says who? Hey, Popeye. Then I get really quiet and invisible. Nothing can hurt me. And just all these stages of drunkenness, like stages of grief.
So you would go into Central Park just looking to have...
I did it a couple of times, just looking for a confrontation. I'd get so heated up, but I was looking for trouble. And so, thank God I never found it. Thank God a lot of stuff never happened to me. I should have the good sense to believe that somebody's watching over me. But in my case, the ego is so fragile. Like, why would they bother? I just got lucky.
Oh.
I'm okay. Thanks. Yeah, never mind. I don't want to bother you.
No, but isn't that a funny thing? To be out there in New York, you're in the place of where you can reinvent yourself. You leave home.
Or invent myself in the first place. Because I kept shifting masks. I go between the jocks, the nerds, the hard guys. I would originally, when I was in like 7th and 8th grade, I would do imitations. I used to be really good. I had a great ear and a much better voice. Well, Gomer Pyle was a big one because I guess it was spot on. And I'd do it for the hard guys, so maybe they'd look out for me. And I'd crack them all up. We were all pals. And then I finally got to a decent size where I didn't have to worry about it much anymore.
I
was class clown. I guess craved attention that much. And I was given the opportunity, had a wonderful education, and I threw it away with both hands in college as well until I got something that interested me. That's how just immature and needy I was. I was more interested in hanging out. Instead of doing it the right way, just doing it my way. Or instead of trusting anybody, just, no, I got this.
It's funny thinking of you as a guy who was worried about the hard guys because...
Well, I was a little fat boy and I had the glasses with the tape in the middle. And I'd wear the same jeans a month in a row.
You would?
I was nerdy, man. I was Daredevil, Spider-Man, James Bond. That was my secret kick.
I just can't get off this idea of you going into Central Park and that was, being angry.
Yeah, that was like 1980s, early 1980s.
So you had some...
I don't know.
You were doing commercials. You had some success at that point.
Yeah.
What do you think you were fighting against?
I think it was being as ungrateful as I could, because I was hanging out at a joint called the Cafe Central on 74 in Amsterdam. And there was a lot of great actors that hung out in there. And I would talk theory with these guys and talk acting, and they were working, and I was doing commercials. And I just really beat myself up over that. That's not the only thing. I was lonely, and I had my friends, but we were all barstool buddies. But no, the 70s, I was too terrified to really do anything. The first winter I was there, I came home from Christmas after my very first job, and I couldn't get arrested. I was still non-equity, and it was fucking cold. I mean, it was the coldest I'd ever been. I was standing in Schubert Alley with my brother's army coat on, looking with the trade paper in my hand, and the wind coming off the Hudson and whipping through that alley. And that's as cold as I remember being. But I was scared all the time, too, because, you know, I used to go to the grocery store with one of those little clicker things that you'd add up the cents that you were, the things you were buying, so you could stay in your budget.
It was that close.
Oh, yeah. I mostly couldn't afford rent after a while.
Do you ever think that you were this close to maybe it not happening?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the first, my cousin came into town. We couldn't afford to go to Broadway shows, but she had tickets for a play, and I went. It was my second Broadway show, and I looked, there was one guy in particular, and I said, I can do this. I got this. I'm all over this. And that's the first time I felt like I could do it, just comparing myself with this guy.
What, how do you measure that? Like, how do you measure yourself?
Well, I was so cocky in college, and then that got knocked out of me when I stepped off the Amtrak train. I was just paralyzed with fear.
Really?
And, you know, little by little, you get a job, and you realize that you're on the right path.
So I remember the first time I saw you, and it was that commercial where you slap yourself in the face and say...
Yeah, that was the first big one I had.
Thanks, I needed that.
Yeah.
Was that Menin?
Menin Skin Bracer.
Right, and I think that was the first jingle that got stuck in my head. didn't they say, bye, Menin?
Menin, bye, Menin.
Yeah. So the thing that's letting you earn a living and stay in New York is also the thing that's making you feel like a fraud, right?
Yeah, but that was me. That was my... Like, I always said I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I'm so much better than this. And that's just fear. That's just fear projecting itself. And not being happy with where I was. And then you throw alcohol into the vortex, and that becomes the vortex. It was great for 5 years. I had a ball, man, going to the bar every night. Then it got a little harder after about 10 years. I mean, I put on about 100 pounds.
In New York?
Of Budweiser. I mean, there were times when, if I didn't go to New York, I would have kicked myself in the ass for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And there was a sense that I was accomplishing that and using what I was trained to do. There was a purpose. I just don't think I could have turned around and gone home.
Did you ever take a method class?
All the acting classes I took were based on the Stanislavski system. Method actors, it's always a misnomer, and it's always used incorrectly. In the early days, they would call guys from the studio torn T-shirt actors from Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, yeah.
Or method actors.
And what did that really mean?
There's a lot of theories about the Stanislavski system. One Lee Strasberg did, which evoked emotional memory. And I'm out of my league here for you acting folks at home. But they would call that method acting, because you go away and you think of something that's going to make you sad. But I think you're much better off using your imagination. But it's research. It's script analysis. There are people who try to live the roles.
Yeah.
And some people are very successful at it. Some people, it just sounds like gibberish. So I'm very careful when I talk about acting, because most of the time I don't know what I'm talking about.
Do you really feel that way?
Lately, yeah, because I'm so far away from where I was in a class, where I was sure that I knew what I was talking about, when I was positive. But And now I'm not so positive anymore. And fatigue kind of burned me out a little bit. So I lost a lot of confidence along the way.
Really?
Yeah, I just kind of started picking it up again Saturday night. Last Thursday, SNL called and I said, you want to, maybe we have something for you.
Live television, the red light goes on, you're on. Is it terrifying?
For me? No, because I got too much to worry about.
What do you mean?
Doing the bit. What am I going to do next? And it's always under rehearsed. So you got to be there. So I don't even think about it.
When you went on stage when you were young or had situations with live audiences or a Saturday Night Live type of situation with live broadcast, was it easy when you were young and then did it get harder later?
The first play I was in was You Can't Take It With You, and I was the patriarch of the family. And we'd rehearse for a couple hours every day. And I got up and I had a big speech to give at the dinner table. And I forgot my lines. I started making things up. And I got up and started pacing. And I went around the back of the table. And by that time, I'd improvised myself back into the script.
Really?
Yeah. And the acting teacher, drama teacher, whatever we called her back then, was beautiful. She was an actress. And she gave me the biggest hug, and I said, hey, maybe there's something in this. But I didn't panic.
You didn't?
No. I went through one period. I was working on a musical on Broadway called Big River.
Yeah?
And I was Huck Finn's dad, Pap, an alcoholic. But there was, we were about 6 months into the show, and for a week, I had to come out and say a line at the same time. And I started sweating, and my pulse went up, and I couldn't remember the first line. And it got to the point where I said, okay, just go out and tell the audience. You're sorry, but you can't remember your first line. And I went out and I opened my mouth and the first line came out. But that happened for about a week. It was stage panic, and then it went away. And I couldn't analyze what happened. I have no idea.
Oh, my gosh.
Maybe it was just complacent or whatever, but no, it was a full panic attack.
I guess I was curious about your critical voice and your, you know, if at some point it was a helpful thing and then it stopped being helpful and you had to sort of listen to it and figure it out.
It's never balanced out.
It's never balanced out.
Because lately I've been overcritical. And I think that's my ego speaking. Oh, you could be so much better. And it's balls, it's bollocks. It just doesn't fit. And then I'll be overly critical. But it works best when it's a matter of taste and a matter of style. And do less.
Do less.
Yeah, you can tell when your critical voice is on the money.
There's a place for a critical voice too that could be helpful.
Definitely, yeah. And that one usually, is spot on.
Really?
Yeah, that's just 40 years of acting, of knowing.
But do you set the bar too high, or did you have to
learn
something?
I always did.
You did?
Yeah, and that's an ego thing.
Do you think you are as hard on other actors' performances as you are on your own?
No. No, because I'll watch somebody and they're not up to snuff, but I still follow the film. So then I just dial into it, and I believe in it. Because
right.
I want to.
But when you're doing the same thing, you're afraid that your performance could be detrimental to the film. Like, you're not giving yourself that same credit.
Yeah, that's that's a bad voice.
Yeah.
And it's not to be listened to. It's because Christ knows what comes into my head half the time. You know, listen to a Charlie Parker solo or something like that, and the rest of the time it's meow 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 meow. Okay, just it'll go away. It'll go away.
Yeah, well, it makes you wonder what goes on in anyone's head. What's going on in Daniel Day-Lewis's head, or what was going on in Marlon Brando's head?
I want to get laid. tonight. Oh yeah, talking about going on in head. Yesterday, a friend of mine called me who I associate with the song I Got You, Babe.
Oh, yeah.
From
Sonny
a film.
And Cher.
Yeah, from a film that he did. And it came on at the same time on the radio yesterday. I was thinking about him. I said, oh, that's pretty weird. So right before I woke up this morning, Cher and I were at an event, and I couldn't stop myself from singing I Got You. And I was embarrassing myself in front of Cher, but I couldn't stop myself from doing it. I don't know if I was hoping that she'd jump in on the girl's part or even Sonny's part.
This is proof that the human mind is, it's unknowable, that you can have a dream.
Yeah.
That you're with Cher.
Yeah.
And of all the things you could be doing with Cher, you're singing her own song.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we got to talk about the Coen brothers, and especially in relation to what you just said about the idea of giving yourself a break or letting a performance be what it is instinctually. I went back over some of the films, and one of the things I noticed is there are some really big moments that you've played in their movies. You're running down a burning hallway, pumping shells into a shotgun and screaming in Barton Fink. You're beating the crap out of George Clooney in Oh Brother.
Well, I beat the shit out of the other guy. He goes, I don't think I get what you're talking about, Big D.
Yeah, and you whack him in the head with a club.
Yeah.
And then in Big Lebowski, obviously, you're pulling a gun on a fellow bowler and you're beating the crap out of a Corvette. Or was it a Corvette?
Yeah.
It was a Corvette.
And I didn't know they'd bought the neighborhood out that night. All I know is I'm out there screaming, cocksucker, stranger, fuck you in the ass, and beating the dog piss out of a Corvette with a crowbar.
Yeah.
And I thought the neighbors are just going to go nuts. And I felt bad that I was going to impose myself on them, even for a good film.
So this long in the film business.
Nobody came out. I go, you guys bought this neighborhood out, didn't you? Go, yeah.
Let me tell you how the film business works, John.
Yeah. Right? Okay. Oh, gosh.
You mean you have a second Corvette? I can beat that one, too.
They did. The Hulk?
No, but I would think that those are scenes and moments where, I mean, even in Raising Arizona, you must have spent half a day screaming in that car, right? Because they shot it from every angle.
Yeah. I've always trusted Joel and Ethan Coen. I've trusted their word. What is on the page to me is gold. It's so good. And like I say, you let that do the work for you.
Well, how did you do that scene where you came out of the mud?
That was, they dug a pit and they covered us with foam rubber to keep the mud on top of it. And then we went down and then popped up. Then we'd have to rinse off and do it again.
When you're doing something like that and it's early in your career and you're with these guys, I would think that not every film, as you go through your career, are you going to be as willing to do whatever they ask, right? But is that a director trust or is it just...
No, absolutely. And because I dug what they were saying.
Yeah.
It was so goddamn funny on the page. And I just wanted to do anything to help.
So you've said many times that it's all on the page with the Coen brothers. Because I've seen interviews with you and you always pretty much say it's all on the page with them. But what does that translate to in your head? Is that when you read their writing...
With Joel and Ethan... To me, the characters are so well delineated that's my job is more than halfway done. I just do what it says. I follow the instructions. And then I get inspired to do something else within character and with the lines. I don't trust myself enough to improvise with their dialogue. I mean, it's just so goddamn good. I just go along with it, you know, let it ride, and then other stuff comes up.
Does that spoil you for other scripts? Like when you read a script, do you have a gut check of what you say yes to?
Joel and Ethan are so unique that it doesn't spoil me because it's different. It's a different style. It's just different from anything else.
But have you had that situation where you've not trusted your gut and you've taken a role and...
Quite a lot of times.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not going to say more often than that, but in a lot of cases, yeah. And that's my lack of trust in myself lately has been damaging to my acting.
God, it seems like so much of this art that you do, it's a fragile thing. It really has to be.
Well, there's another, there's an AA slogan that says, fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
You just pretend like you're getting it. And pretend like you're on top of it. You don't want anybody to panic. And they'll tell you what to do. If you're getting it wrong, the directors will. So you just go along with it.
I think maybe it is the territory of an artist to be 40 years into their career and still wondering if they can pull it off. Like, that to me really is what it's about, right? Because if you walked in going, I got this, and I know how to do this, that'd be boring to watch.
Yeah, it's boring to live that way, too. But
are you attracted to the higher wire nature of things like Saturday Night Live?
I must be.
Yeah, you must be, right?
I must be, because I trust Lorne and everybody at SNL to just jump off the deep end.
Yeah.
And this time, like I say, my confidence came back because I was having fun with it. Something I hadn't done on the last couple times I've been there. I was overly worried about whether I fit in with the cast, if I got what they were talking about, because they're so much younger than I am now. They have different ways of thinking, but you know, a couple of people you talk to that you really respect and like, and that's all it takes. It's just a couple of the great people in there. And the writers are always your friend.
It's funny you say that, and I think of you throughout your life needing to find somebody or something to latch onto, because you didn't really have that.
Yeah. Well, I got very lucky in marriage.
Yeah.
She tolerated me. And she put up with 20 years of drinking and drug use, which she didn't know about. But and then, you know, I was hiding, toward the end, hiding bottles in the house.
Really?
Yeah. It's just, it never ends well.
What you're describing is that you've hung on to something. Like, this self-destructive side of you that you keep hinting at is, it's like, I don't know, something inside you that has to screw things up when they get good.
Well, that was a long time, and it's abated. I'm all, now that I've got about 10, 15 years left, I'm all about self-preservation.
Well, okay, so maybe that's a good transition to,
yeah,
to Roseanne. Because, you know, I was looking at the timeline, and it's been 30 years since that show started.
Yep.
These kids that were on it in the original show, they're full-fledged old adults now.
Yeah.
Like, how did this idea of the reboot get floated to you?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Sarah Gilbert has a talk show on CBS called The Talk, which she produces.
Right.
I went on there to promote something. They asked me, would you like to do a little sketch with Sarah at the top of the show? It was sitting on a couch, like I was Dan Connor, the character from Roseanne, and she was Darlene, my daughter. And it was a little three-minute bit. And doing that, like, wow, nothing's changed. Nothing has changed. This was like an old Gucci loafer. I wouldn't know, but it improves with age. And then right before my segment was over, she goes, John, would you think you'd ever do a reunion of Roseanne? I said, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Because it was fun, you know, before I screwed things up for myself. We had a ball showing up every day at the studio. It was like family. And Rosie and I loved to laugh. So I said, yeah. She called Roseanne that day and said, John said he'd be up for a reunion show. She goes, if John wants to do it, yeah, I want to do it. And 3 weeks later, we had a deal with ABC.
No kidding.
And we got Tom Werner, the original head producer, is in charge. It's a good group, and it was magic stepping into our reading. I was overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude, which carried me through the 3 months or so we filmed this year. And everybody was the same. We were so grateful to be back and having so much goddamn fun. But the first time I stepped onto that set, they reproduced everything down to the wallpaper. It was like, it's a 20-year absence that seemed like a 2-week Christmas break.
Did it really?
Yeah, and it was like a sense of belonging, a sense of comfort, and it was offset by the bizarre nature of it all. I don't have the language to describe it. It's a deja vu, but much stronger. And then when we started rehearsing, 20 years had vanished.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Did you experience the same sense of chemistry with Roseanne right off, even though you two have to be wildly different people now?
When I went in there to audition for the role, I was in town for shooting something.
In 88 or whatever, 87?
Yeah, 87. Yeah, I had like 3 movies in the can then. So I was really whipping up on a film career. And I went in and read for this with this woman who I only knew from a pizza commercial. And I hadn't seen her act yet, but she was making a lot of noise.
Did you know her as a comedian?
Yeah,
too?
Yeah. We just hit it off right away. It was wonderful. Yeah, we got each other.
And was that still intact?
Yeah.
It was?
Very much so.
So do you believe in that idea of chemistry?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. But for lack of a better term, we'll use chemistry.
And have you not had it enough in other situations to recognize its power or recognize the absence of it? Or
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah?
But with us, it's really strong.
It is?
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. We hit it off from Jump Street, and I think I'm the only guy that auditioned.
Really?
Yeah.
What always struck me about that show is, and that time in American history, is that was sort of around the time where we still as a country all watched the same television shows and everyone knew those families. And you as a person, as an actor, are in people's homes in an intimate way every week for 9 years. You know, and I think that will never happen again.
We'll never get those numbers again.
No.
There's too much other stuff to watch.
But what I was always curious about with that was a lot of television is aspirational and it's, you know, beautiful, skinny people being, you know, being, having these lives that we sit on our couch and we think we want.
When we started, the audience was watching Dynasty,
right.
Dallas. We followed Moonlighting.
There's the Love Boat, and there was the, yeah, you know, there's these things where literally you can imagine a room full of executives going, well, we'll have a show about on a cruise ship that everyone who can't afford a cruise ship
yeah.
will want to watch this show.
With ex-stars.
Right.
We fixed that shit.
But when Roseanne started, you know, seeping into the consciousness after, what, a season or so, I was always curious about the feedback you would get from people.
I asked a lot of questions because I was supposed to lay drywall on the show. I can't do shit with my hands. I can wipe. And I wash them, and then I'll grab food with them. And they're just never been my friends as far as picking up tools. Maybe it's the opposable thumbs thing I haven't figured out yet. Me and tools, just, we don't get along. Don't try me. But, you know, then I started asking my friends in St. Louis about, you know, working drywall. What does it take? What do we do? And these are guys that I know that are still doing the same thing. Maybe, you know, some of them are living paycheck to paycheck. And I brought a lot of those guys onto the character.
Well,
I came from there. I mean, that's, I'm a Midwestern kid, lower middle class. So it was a good fit.
Did you get a sense that people were, when they would come up and talk to you,
I'm everybody's dad.
Like you represent them.
Yeah.
Right?
Or, at the time, it was my brother-in-law or an uncle. Yeah, I know you. But there was a real sense of connection with the audience, with a lot of the audience. And they were us.
Yeah.
And I'm not claiming to represent anybody, but a lot of people felt that we were them.
Is there something that it took the show ending the first time for you to realize about it?
When the show ended the first time, I tried to get out of my contract the year before.
Okay.
And ABC kind of assured me they would have no problem with taking my house.
Really?
Yeah. There'd be legal shit involved. So I let it go. But I was, at the time, drank myself into a place where I was ungrateful. I was drinking at work.
Oh, you were on Roseanne.
Yeah, I wanted to get out. This is my own fault. This is my own problem. But that's where I was at the end of the show. And the last season, they said, well, you come back and you can do as many as you want. So I did half the season. Yeah, I don't even know if I saw the last show where we found out that I was dead.
Right.
Yeah.
Which conveniently didn't matter.
Yeah.
Here he is. He's alive.
Why do people keep saying I'm dead?
But the idea that you're so miserable and unhappy at that point, and then you get a chance to sort of have a do-over.
I didn't know how lucky I was, man. I drank myself into the place where I earned everything that I got, as I did it on my own, and I had no help. Yeah, it was just a terrible attitude to have. And I blame my alcoholism on that and the things that creates in your head. you know, it had to come from somewhere, but that's just bad air. And I wanted, and well, I thought about it after we wrapped this time, that I was making amends.
Really?
Yeah, for my attitude in the last 2 years of that show. By being, nobody gets this lucky. And to be able to do this again and go back there and have the fun that we had and have the great feeling where I want to go to work every day, getting there, get there early, my coffee, read the script, get my lines down, eat my spinach. The gratitude that I felt was immense.
So around that time, when you're drinking pretty heavily, season, what, 8 of Roseanne,
yeah.
You've got a daughter probably what?
She was born in 1990, so, she'd be
okay. So
five or 6 years old.
Okay, so, because that was right around the time when you moved to New Orleans,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
So that period in your life, the tabloids seemed to follow Roseanne around.
Yeah, well, I got the backsplash from that.
Right.
That's one of the reasons I moved out.
And I wondered if that move was in some ways also a father move.
Oh, definitely.
It was.
I don't want to say this to disparage Los Angeles because it's a great city. I just didn't want her growing up in a showbiz environment, which I regarded as we're all carnies. We're all carnival workers. But I was getting residual stuff from the tabloids with Roseanne. I walked a buddy of mine's girlfriend out of a club one night, and he was right behind us, but they had me leaving my wife. Divorce proceedings are imminent, and I don't even know the girl's name. But she was a home wrecker. It was just little things like that mounted up after a while. I had a gated house.
Right.
In Encino, and I did that for a reason, but I'd had enough. So we found a secluded part of New Orleans and moved there first. She went to a great school, and she loved it. It was a wonderful school.
Because I would imagine no one is prepared for, first off, that kind of intense scrutiny and success, and the fact you're battling alcoholism, which is, who knows where that comes from.
I wasn't battling real hard at the time.
but you know, and then I'm sure questions come up like, am I being a good dad? I'm earning money, but
yeah.
Am I?
That was my whole thing, was I'm providing. So that I let myself off the hook for a lot of bad behavior because I was providing.
Right.
I never talked to my daughter about the effect my alcoholism had on her. I'm sure it was, she turned out great, but she had her mother and her grandmother to teach her manners. And she's a very polite young lady. I remember one time we were in a swimming pool and she you couldn't tell her what to do. I'm gonna do this. She dived off my shoulders and hit the step in the pool. The lovely little black eye. So I take her to the store and people would go, They think I was beating her.
Oh, God. See, I wouldn't. I mean,
I ought to just went.
Do you think that because of the stuff you've gone through, you have a propensity for accepting guilt or assuming that it's your fault?
I can't let myself think like that. I'm pretty. If I'm at fault with something, I will try to correct it. And I'm pretty open now about seeing what that is. But if I start wallowing in guilt, which I do, I'll go down to a path where it's no good. It's no good for, because I'm depressive anyway.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, and I know that I am, and I observe myself, and it's fine. But if I trigger myself into going down another, I'll just start sinking down.
Well, it sounds like you've come out the other side of that, at least being able to recognize it.
For today, yeah.
For today.
Yeah.
That's sort of how an alcoholic has to live, right?
Yeah.
For one day at a time.
It is, and that's all the cliche signs they hang up at the meetings, they're all true. And I found that out early on. Believe the cliches, because they're cliches for a reason. One day at a time, that's all I've got. If at any time I felt like drinking, I put it off for an hour or make myself call somebody. It never happened yet, but you're one day at a time. You're only sober one day at a time.
Well, John, I have to say, I really have enjoyed getting to know you a little bit. I love talking to you. I think that you're such a talented guy, and genuinely, you don't trade on that talent or don't count on it. You just, you know what I mean? You're a good man.
Thank you.
And I thank you for being so candid about your life.
Was I What did I say? Thank you, Foster Brooks.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. This was special. This was a pleasure.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, should we roll the credits?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey folks, that's our show for this time. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. And to see what we are talking about, go check out the new episodes of Roseanne. And you should also rewatch every Coen Brothers movie that John is in, because why not? That's what streaming is for. Start with Raising Arizona, and then watch Barton Fink, The Hudsucker Proxy, The Big Lebowski, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and Inside Llewyn Davis. After seeing John's performances in these films back to back, it is hard to overstate his power of transformation and character interpretation, even if it is all on the page, like he says. And did you know that Off Camera is also all on the page and all on TV? Go to offcamera.com and check out our TV show, our magazine, and our store. And did you know that by getting a monthly subscription to Off Camera, you can watch our entire archive of shows on any device, anywhere you like? This is by far the best way to experience Off Camera, and it also supports the show when you get the subscription, so that we can keep bringing you content every week. So go to the website, offcamera.com, and see all that we have to offer. Oh, and if you're a fan of the show, or a fan of my photography, you have to check out Off Camera The Portraits. This is our 275-page coffee table book, printed in four-color black and white, that is full of never-before-seen images of the iconic artists that have appeared on our show. It makes a great addition to your library and a great gift. And if you get one now, I will sign it. I will even inscribe it to you or your loved one if you send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. So get yours while we still have some. Also, if you're a fan of the show, don't be shy about telling people about it. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. So give us a shout out. I want to thank all the fine folks who work on this show every week. We have our sound editor, Nathan Shields, who is standing here right now in his headphones looking at me as I say this. Our visual artist, Michaela Galvin, who is either working on our magazine right now or eating something delicious and full of sugar. Our producer, Crawford Shippey, who's probably on the phone trying to book our next guest as we speak. Our studio manager, Sasha Snow, who might just be buried in paperwork and needing help. And our transcriptionist, Kara Johnson, who is hopefully transcribing away. And finally, our own Matt Davidson, who is currently plucking splinters from his forearms. Don't ask. Now, most importantly, be sure to join me next time when I sit down with the affable and huggable Zach Woods.
In the first season, TJ Miller told me, I didn't even remember this, but he like apparently came into my trailer and I was cross-legged on a yoga mat reading a purple journal of affirmations with candles lit around me, listening to the Indigo Girls. And so he was like, oh, this is, you're just playing yourself. like you're basically Jared.
Better known currently as Jared on HBO's brilliant satire, Silicon Valley, but thought of by many, including Mike Judge, to be one of the world's greatest improvisers. As we find out in our conversation, Zach is also a pretty good trumpet player, an accidentally narcissistic lurker, a reciter of death poems, possibly a Wiccan, and someone who definitely has some unresolved sleep issues. See you next time, off camera.